Scene 1.
Richard had reached toward us and wrenched the world right out of orbit. Everything tilted, hurtled forward. As soon as those three words, "He's still alive," were out of James's mouth, he was running headlong to the end of the dock.
"Richard!"
Wren croaked, the sound involuntary and compulsive like a cough. Her cousin lay convulsing in the water, blood bubbling vivid red on his lips as one hand groped toward us.
"James!"
Alexander's voice, shrill and frantic, pierced through the gloom.
"Oliver, grab him!"
I stumbled into a sprint, feet pounding on the wet planks, seized by the senseless fear that James would throw himself into the water and let Richard drag him under.
"James!"
My fingers scraped off the back of his jacket, closed on nothing.
"Stop!"
I made one more reckless grab and caught him clumsily around the waist. He lost his balance and pitched forward with a cry of surprise. For one terrible moment, the water rushed up to meet us, but just as I gasped to go under, James slammed into the dock chest first, and I crashed down on top of him. Pain went howling through my limbs, but I didn't let go, hoping that my weight would be enough to hold him down. Wren tried to call out again, but gagged and swallowed her voice.
"Can he hear us?"
Alexander said.
"Jesus, can he even hear us?"
My head hung over the edge of the dock, pulse pounding between my temples, eyes open wide. Richard, just out of reach, gulped against the thick slime of blood in his mouth. His limbs were twisted and bent around him like the broken wings of a bird, pushed too soon from the nest, unready for flight. Hamlet stirred in my memory. "There's a special providence," he says, "in the fall of a sparrow."
"He's not dead!"
James writhed underneath me.
"He's not dead! Get off!"
"No," Alexander said sharply.
"Wait!"
Philippa's voice broke through, closer than Alexander's.
"Oliver!"
I felt her hands on my shoulders, dragging me away from the edge.
"Get up," she said. "Get him away from there!"
"James, come on!" I hauled him backward, pulled him to his feet. He strained feebly against my arms, and I worried for a moment that I might have broken his ribs. Behind us, Wren was on her knees moaning, and Meredith crouched beside her, face livid, her expression less like terror than rage.
"Let go of me!"
James said, half trying to push me off.
"Let go!"
"Not if you're going to do something crazy," Alexander said.
"Just wait a minute!" "We can't wait! He's dying!"
"And we're going to what? Leap in and save him? All the king's horses and all the king's men? Shut up and think for one fucking minute." "Think about what?" I asked, still holding James, but not sure why.
"I mean, how did this even happen?"
Alexander asked, of nobody in particular.
"Well, he fell," Philippa said immediately. "He must have."
"He just fell?" I said.
"Pip, look at his face."
"So he smashed his head on something," Meredith said. "After how much he drank, are you really surprised?"
"God, Richard,"
Wren said again, but seething now, wiping angrily at her eyes.
"Richard, you idiot!"
"Hey, stop that."
Alexander yanked her up off her knees.
"Don't cry over him. It's his own fucking fault." "Are you all insane?"
James demanded, looking wildly from one of them to each of the others. He'd stopped straining against my grip as if he'd forgotten I was holding him.
"We have to help him!"
"Do we?" Alexander asked, whirling around, taking one impulsive step toward him.
"I mean, do we really?"
"Alexander, he's still alive!"
"Yeah, exactly."
"What?"
I said, but neither of them seemed to hear me.
"We can't just stand around arguing about how it happened. We have to do something,"
James started, but Alexander cut him off.
"Look, I know you have a pathological need to play the hero, but right now you need to stop and ask yourself if that's really what's best for everyone."
I stared at him, appalled.
"What are you saying?"
James asked faintly, as if he already knew the answer. Alexander stood with his long arms braced at his sides, twitching with a kind of crazed potential energy. He glanced over his shoulder at the water. Richard's last convulsion had subsided, and he lay unnervingly motionless, as if he were playing dead. The water was smooth and dark as velvet now, except for the weak flutter of his exhalations that gave him away. "If it be now," I thought, "'tis not to come."
"All I'm saying is, let's not do anything before we've thought it through," Alexander said, sweat gleaming on his temples despite the raw November chill. "I mean, do you not remember what he's been like the last few weeks? Clobbering us on stage. We're covered in bruises. He nearly drowned you on Halloween, and last night?"
He looked at me.
"You and Meredith?"
There was a sharp stabbing pain in my chest.
"Richard completely lost his mind. You didn't hear him ranting about what he'd do when he got his hands on you. If he wasn't in the water right now, you probably would be."
"We had to stop him breaking in," Philippa said.
I'd forgotten how close she was standing beside me, one hand on my back, until she spoke and I felt the vibration of her voice. "He almost put Alexander through the wall."
"Never mind me. What about Wren?" Alexander said, but he was appealing to James, not her. "You were there. You saw it."
"What did he do?"
Meredith said, when James didn't answer. Wren squeezed her eyes shut.
"What did he do to her?"
"She tried to stop him storming off," Philippa said, talking quietly, whispering like Richard might hear, like she was afraid to wake him. "He threw her across the yard. He could have broken every bone in her body."
"You think all that's going to stop?"
Alexander asked, with a throb of fear in his voice.
"You think we'll pull him out of the water and he'll be fine and we'll all be friends again?"
A thin silence answered him.
"If it be not to come, it will be now."
Alexander forced one nervous hand into his pocket and found the stub end of a cigarette. His lighter flared and he cupped his fingers around the flame as if it were something unspeakably precious. At the first breath in, he shivered, and when he exhaled again, his voice was lower, if not quite steady.
"Don't say it out loud if you don't want to. But 5 minutes ago, when we thought he was dead, what did you feel?"
Philippa's face was ashen but unreadable. Silver tear tracks glistened on Wren's cheeks. Beside her, Meredith was upright and immovable as a statue. James stood suspended between her and me, mouth open in abject, childlike horror. Around us, the trees' bristling black silhouettes stood eerily straight and motionless, and thin clouds strung across the milky sky like smoke. The world was no longer dark. A cold light had broken and crouched low on the horizon, prowling the no man's land between night and day. I forced myself to look down at Richard. If he was breathing, I couldn't hear it, but even in that silence, he was snarling, teeth bared and seamed with blood. I felt it on the tip of my tongue, the compulsion to confess that in that perilous instant when I thought he was dead, all I'd really felt was relief.
"So," Meredith said, and it seemed somehow that she was speaking for all of us.
Her warm vivacity was gone, and there was something about how coldly sober and steady she looked that sent pins and needles prickling down my spine.
"What do you suggest we do?"
Alexander shrugged, and there was something terribly momentous in that simple, meaningless gesture.
"Nothing."
For a long time, nobody spoke. Nobody protested. I was stunned by their reticence until I realized I hadn't spoken either. James's voice finally stirred in the dead air.
"We have to help him.
We have to."
"Why, James?" Meredith said, quietly, reproachfully, as if he had somehow betrayed her. You of all people should understand. We don't owe him anything. James averted his eyes, perhaps in defiance, perhaps in shame, and Meredith turned her gorgon gaze on me. Every tiny intimacy of the previous night came creeping back to mind. Her lips against my skin and Richard's ugly fingerprints on hers, neither more persuasive than the other. I swallowed a hard lump in my throat. If it be not now, yet it will come. Alexander was fidgeting, on the verge of interrupting, but he shut his mouth when I moved, shifted, put myself between James and the rest of them. He twitched at the weight of my hands on his shoulders. Since no man knows aught of what he leaves, what is't to leave betimes? I said. He looked at me with unbearable mistrust, as if I were a stranger, someone he didn't recognize. I pulled him just an inch closer, trying to tell him in some impossible way that I wanted him and the others unhurt and unafraid more than I wanted Richard alive, and we couldn't have both any more. James, please, let be. He stared at me a moment longer, then let his head droop again. Wren, he said, turning just enough that he could see her from the corner of his eye. She looked impossibly young, huddled between Meredith and Alexander, arms wrapped tight around her stomach as if they wouldn't unwind. But she seemed to have wept all the softness out of her cool brown eyes. She didn't speak, didn't even open her mouth, just nodded slowly. Yes. Something wretchedly like a laugh slipped out between James's lips. Do it then, he said. Let him die. That loathsome opiate relief raced through my veins again, sharp and lucid at the initial prick before everything went numb. I heard one of the others, maybe Philippa, exhale, and I knew I wasn't the only one who felt it. The moral outrage we should have suffered was quietly put down, suppressed like an unpleasant rumor before it had a chance to be heard. Whatever we did, or more crucially, did not do, it seemed that so long as we did it together, our individual sins might be abated. There is no comfort like complicity. Alexander tried to say something, but a wet, spluttering sound made us all look toward the lake. Richard's head had lolled to one side, low enough that the water lapped at his nose and mouth and left a cloud of dark, hematic red around his face. His whole body stiffened, seized up, the muscles in his neck and arms bulging like steel cables, though he didn't seem to be able to move his limbs. The rest of us watched in a state of rigid paralysis. There was a distant groan, the sound trapped somehow inside his body, unable to find a way out. One last little spasm went through him, the hand that had so futilely stretched toward the sound of our voices opening like a flower. The fingers flexed, closed again, shrank back toward the palm. Then everything was still. At long last, Alexander rolled his shoulders forward, and all the smoke he'd been holding in his lungs spilled out at once. Well, he said to the rest of us, suddenly calm and placid as the lake that lay behind him. What now? The question was so absurd, and the way he said it so ludicrously casual, that I had to clench my teeth against a psychotic impulse to laugh. My classmates shifted around me, turning inward toward one another, away from the water. Their faces were smooth, impassive, the panic of a minute before forgotten. No reason to fuss now. No rush. I couldn't help but wonder if my own expression was so staid, if perhaps I was a better actor than I'd always thought, and none of them suspected that there was some sick, silent laughter trapped in my throat. Philippa. We need to decide what to tell the police about what happened.
Alexander. To him? Who knows? I don't even know where I was half the night.
Meredith. You can't say that. Someone's dead and you don't know where you were?
Me. Jesus, it's not like one of us did this.
Philippa. No, of course not.
Me.
He was drunk. He drank himself blind and went crashing into the woods.
Wren.
They're going to want to know why one of us didn't go after him.
Alexander.
Because he's a violent fucking lunatic and he chucked you across the yard?
Meredith.
She can't say that, you idiot. It sounds like a motive.
James. Then you had better not say where you were either.
He spoke so softly I almost didn't hear him. He watched Meredith without embellishing, his face white and stiff as a plaster cast.
Sorry,
she said. What motive do I have to kill my boyfriend?
Well, what I remember about last night is your boyfriend calling you a slut in front of everyone and you rushing upstairs to revenge fuck Oliver. Or have I left something out?
He looked from her to me, and that pain in my chest was back, like he'd grasped an invisible dagger and twisted it between my ribs.
Look, he's right, Philippa said, before Meredith could argue. We don't know what happened to Richard, but there's no sense making this more difficult for ourselves. Least said, soonest mended.
Okay, but we can't avoid the fight in the kitchen because half the school was there, Alexander said, then gestured from Meredith to me. And someone saw these two morons making out in the stairwell.
He was drunk, Meredith snapped. Drunker than you, and you don't even know where you were.
Philippa talked over them. We were all drinking, so any question you don't want to answer, just say you don't remember.
And the rest? James asked.
What do you mean?
Wren said.
The rest.
You know. Before.
Philippa, as always, was quickest to understand.
Not a word about Halloween, she said, or the assassination scene, or anything else.
So, what? Alexander said. Before last night, everything was just fine?
Philippa's face was perfectly blank, and I could already picture her sitting across from some rookie police officer, back straight, knees together, ready to answer whatever question he threw at her.
Yes, precisely, she said.
Before last night, everything was fine. Wren scuffed her toes against the dock, glancing away, avoiding everyone's eyes.
And this morning?
She said in a very small voice.
Nobody ever comes out here besides the seven of us, Alexander said. So we say we've just found him.
And what are we supposed to have been doing up till now? I asked.
Sleeping, Meredith said. The sun's not even up.
But as she spoke, the shrill call of a bird echoed between the trees, and we knew it wouldn't be long. I glanced toward the end of the dock where Richard lay unmoving in the water, unable to push Hamlet's poor fallen sparrow out of my head.
The readiness is all.
Alexander said as much in humbler words.
What time is it? Are we sure he's shuffled off?
No, Philippa said. But before we call the police, we need to be.
Another silence, just long enough for the fear we'd briefly forgotten to come creeping back.
I'll do it, Meredith said.
She dragged her fingers through her hair, then let her arms fall to her sides again. I'd seen her do it 1,000 times before. Push her hair back from her face, steel herself, and step into the spotlight. But to watch her disappear into the freezing water was more than I could stomach.
No. I said. I'll go.
Everyone looked at me like I'd lost my mind except Meredith. A kind of desperate gratitude flitted across her face, so fast I almost didn't see it. All right, she said. Go. I nodded, mostly to myself. When I'd spoken, I'd done it thinking only of her, not of what I would have to do in her place. The others drifted apart, leaving a narrow path for me to walk to the end of the dock. I stood numb and unmoving for a second or two, then put one foot forward. 3 slow steps put them all behind me. I paused, reached down to pull my shoes off. 3 more steps. I unzipped my jacket and dropped it on the dock, tugged my sweatshirt off over my head. The cold air stung my bare skin, and goosebumps crept from my scalp, down my spine and my arms and legs, until every hair on my body was standing on end. 3 more steps. The lake had never seemed so enormous, so dark, or so deep. Richard had sunk almost beneath the surface, like a toppled statue, and only marmoreal fragments emerged, 3 fingers loosely curled, the slope of a collarbone, sensuous twist of the throat. Misery set in stone. A thin film of crimson clung to his skin, too bright, too lurid for that place of misty grays and evergreen. Fear seized my heart in a pitiless grip and crushed it to a small, hard lump like a cherry stone. I stared down at him until I thought my blood would freeze if I didn't move. I looked back to tell the others that I couldn't do it, couldn't go any closer, couldn't plunge into that black water, couldn't prod his crooked throat in search of a pulse. But the sight of them huddled together, like 5 children afraid of the dark, watching me and waiting for some kind of reassurance, made my own fear seem selfish. I held my breath, closed my eyes, and stepped off the dock. Scene 2. 2 hours later, I hadn't stopped shivering. We sat in a line against the wall in a 3rd-floor hallway where it was more than warm enough. I'd been given a blanket and a dry pair of jeans, but no time to shower. Worse than the lingering chill was the sensation of the lake water and Richard's blood seeping into my skin, burning and itching on every inch of my body. Philippa, sitting uncomfortably close on my left, lifted one hand without looking at me and placed it so lightly on the inside of my wrist that I barely felt it. She, James, Alexander, and Wren had already given their statements. Meredith was in the office giving hers while I waited in a state of catatonic anxiety to give mine. The door opened with a heavy scrape and Meredith reappeared. I tried unsuccessfully to catch her eye until I heard Holinshed say, "Mr. Marks." Philippa's hand slid off my arm. I stood and moved toward the door with the brittle mechanical motion of the Tin Man. Pausing on the threshold, I glanced at my classmates again. They sat with their faces all turned away, looking anywhere but at me or one another, except Alexander, who gave me the smallest secret nod. I bowed my head and ducked into the room. It was bigger than I expected, like the gallery, but lower-ceilinged, not as bright. The windows gazed out over the long sweeping drive at the front of the hall, the stately iron gate reduced to thorny black bars in the distance. I twitched as the door boomed shut behind me. There were 4 other people in the room. Frederick, standing in the corner by the window, Holinshed, leaning on the enormous claw-footed desk with his chin tucked against his chest, Gwendolyn, sitting behind the desk with her head in her hands, and a younger, broad-shouldered man with sandy hair wearing a brown bomber jacket over a shirt and tie. I'd already caught a glimpse of him down at the castle before they herded us up to the hall.
"Morning, Oliver."
He extended a hand, which I shook with clammy fingers, realizing that I must look vaguely ridiculous, what with a moth-eaten blanket hanging from my shoulders like some derelict sovereign's cape.
"This is Detective Colborne,"
Holinshed said. He peered at me over the rims of his glasses,
expression unforgiving and severe. He's going to ask you some questions about Richard. Gwendolyn gave a small whimper and covered her mouth.
Okay,
I said. My tongue felt like sandpaper.
There's no need to be nervous,
Colborne said, and that same hysterical laughter from 2 hours earlier echoed in my brain.
I just need you to tell me what happened, and if you don't remember, it's all right to tell me you don't remember. No information is better than wrong information.
Okay.
Why don't you sit? Might make things easier.
He gestured to the chair waiting behind me. There was another one in front of Holinshed's desk, facing me, empty. I lowered myself into the chair, wondering if it would vanish before I got there and let me fall to the floor. In that moment, nothing seemed certain or solid, not even the furniture. Colborne sat across from me in the other chair and reached into his pocket. His hand emerged again with a small black tape recorder, which he placed behind him on the edge of Holinshed's desk. It was already on, a little red light glaring at me.
"You mind if I record this?"
Colborne asked, politely enough, but I knew I couldn't refuse.
"If I don't have to write everything down, I can pay closer attention to what you're saying."
I nodded and adjusted my blanket. Dignity was immaterial, and I didn't know what else to do with my hands. Colborne leaned forward and said,
"So, Oliver. All right if I call you Oliver?"
"Sure."
"And you're a fourth-year theater student?"
I didn't know if I was expected to answer, so I said, a half-second too late, "Yes." Colborne didn't seem to notice, only offered another non-question.
"Dean Holinshed tells me you're from Ohio."
"Yes," I said again, too late.
"You miss home at all?"
he asked, and I was almost relieved. "No." I could have told him that as far as I was concerned, Delacour was home, but I didn't want to say any more than I had to. "Colborne, how big is your hometown?" "Me. Average, I guess. Bigger than Broadwater." "Colborne,
did you do theater in high school?"
"Me. Yes." "Colborne,
did you like it? How was it?"
"Me. It was all right. Not like here."
"Colborne, because here is..."
"Me. Better." "Colborne,
are you close, the six of you?"
It sounded alien, the six of us. We had always been seven. "Like siblings," I said, and immediately regretted it, uncertain how quickly the word rivalry would come to mind.
"You share a room with James Farrow," Colborne said more quietly. "Is that where you slept last night?"
I nodded, not quite trusting myself to speak. We'd decided that James would account for me. The fact that one drunk first year saw me on the stairs with Meredith didn't mean we had to admit to what had happened after.
"And what time did you go to bed?"
Colborne said. 2:30, something like that."
"Okay.
Talk me through what happened at the party, and be as specific as possible." My eyes flicked from Colborne to Frederick to Holinshed. Gwendolyn sat staring down at the top of the desk, her hair limp and tired-looking.
"There aren't any wrong answers," Colborne added.
His voice had a soft scratch to it that made him sound older than he was. "Right, yeah. I'm sorry." I tightened my grip on the blanket, wishing my palms would stop sweating. "Well, James and Alexander and I walked down from the Fab a little after 10:30, and we weren't in a rush, so we probably got to the castle about 11. We got drinks, and then we all got separated. Wandered around for a while. Someone told me Richard was upstairs drinking by himself."
"Any idea why he wasn't socializing with everyone else?"
Colborne asked. "Not really," I said. Figured he'd come down when he was ready. He nodded.
Go on.
I looked toward the window, to the long winding road that led away from Delacour, disappearing into the gray. I went outside, talked to Wren, talked to James. Then there was a bunch of noise, I guess, from inside. So we went in to see what was happening. It was just me and James by then. I don't know where Wren went.
And you were in the yard, is that right?
Yes.
When you went inside, what happened?
I shifted in my chair. Two different memories were fighting for dominance, the truth and the version of it we'd agreed to tell. It was confusing, I said, feeling some fleeting comfort in the honesty of those three words. The music was loud and everyone was talking at the same time, but Richard had hit somebody. I don't remember his name. Colin brought him up to the infirmary.
Alan Boyd, Hollinshed had said. We'll be discussing this with him, too.
Colborne didn't acknowledge the interjection, his attention fixed on me.
And what then?
Richard and Meredith were arguing. I don't know exactly what it was about. More accurately, I wasn't sure how much Meredith had told them.
The others made it sound like Alan had been paying her a little more attention than Richard was comfortable with,
Colborne said. Maybe, I don't know. Richard was drunk, beyond drunk, belligerent. He said some pretty nasty things. Meredith was upset and she went upstairs to get away from everybody. I went after her just to make sure she was all right. We were talking in her room. A few vivid moments of Meredith flashed in my brain, strands of auburn hair caught in her lipstick, black silk lines at the edges of her eyelids, the strap of her dress sliding down off her shoulder. We were talking in her room and Richard came up and started pounding on the door, I said, too quickly, hoping Colborne wouldn't notice how warm my face and throat had gotten. She didn't want to talk to him, and she told him as much, through the door. We were sort of afraid to open it, and eventually he went away.
What time was this?
God, I don't remember. Late. 1:30, maybe?
When Richard left, do you know where he went?
No, I said, exhaling a little more easily. Another scrap of truth. We didn't come out for a while.
And when you did?
Everyone was gone, really. I went up to bed. James was already there, but not quite asleep. I tried to picture him rolling over on his side to whisper to me across the room, but all I could see was the dim yellow light of the bathroom, steam and hot water warping his features in the mirror. He told me Richard had gone off into the woods with a bottle of scotch.
And that was the last you heard of him?
Until Alexander found him? The prismatic memories of the previous night fell away, and the cold of the morning crept through me. I could feel the water on my skin, in my hair, under my fingernails. Yes.
All right,
Colborne said. He spoke gently, the way you talk to spooked horses and crazy people.
Now, I'm sorry to ask this, but I need you to tell me what you saw this morning.
I could still see it. Richard suspended on the surface of life, bloodied, gasping, and the rest of us simply watching, waiting for the curtain to drop. Revenge tragedy, I wanted to say. Shakespeare himself couldn't have done it better. I saw Richard, I told him. Not a proper dead man, not really floating. Just sort of hanging there, but broken and crushed, like everything was bent the wrong way.
And you...
He cleared his throat.
You got in the water.
It was the first time he hesitated. Yes. I pulled the blanket closer as if it could somehow thaw me, shield me from the feeling of cold water closing in around me. I knew, sitting there in the dry warmth of Hollinshed's office, that I'd never forget it. How my lungs shrank so suddenly I thought they would shatter, gasping more in shock than for oxygen. Richard's face, much too close, white as bone. The sour iron smell of blood. That insane urge to laugh was back, as strong as the urge to vomit, and for one harrowing moment I thought I would be sick all over the carpet at Colborne's feet. I swallowed again, choked everything down. He mistook my wave of nausea for emotion and respectfully waited for me to compose myself. Eventually, I managed to say, "Someone had to."
"And he was dead?"
I could have told him how it felt to reach for Richard's throat and find the flesh cold, that vein that had once bulged and throbbed in anger, flat and finally still. Instead, all I said was, "Yes." He stared at me with a brittle sort of look, deliberately blank, like a bad poker face. Before I could guess what he didn't want me to see, he blinked, leaned back.
"Well, that can't have been easy. I'm sorry."
I nodded, unsure of whether I was supposed to thank him or if condolences were in his job description.
"Just one more question, if you're up for it."
"Whatever you need."
"Tell me about the last few weeks," he said loosely, as if it were only a matter of course. "You've all been under a lot of pressure, Richard maybe most of all. Was he behaving strangely?"
Another mosaic of memories took shape like a stained glass window, shards of color and light. The white glow of the moon on the water at Halloween, the blue bruises on James's arms, the bright, ripe red of blood creeping out of Meredith's silk sleeve. My stomach, knotted and clenched a moment before, unexpectedly unwound. My pulse slowed. "No," I said. Philippa's words echoed softly in my head. "Before last night, everything was fine." Colborne watched me with curious closeness.
"I think that's all for now," he said after what felt like too long a pause. "I'm going to give you my contact information. If you think of anything else, please don't hesitate to tell me."
"Of course," I said. "I will." But of course, I wouldn't. Not until 10 years later.
Scene 3. Up on the 5th floor of Delacour Hall was a secret cache of rooms reserved for the school's more illustrious guests. This peculiar apartment had 3 bedrooms, 1 bathroom, and a large central drawing room that contained a fireplace, a collection of elegant Victorian furniture, and a baby grand piano. Halsworth House, as it was called after Leopold Delacour's wealthy in-laws, was where the faculty decided to hide the 6 remaining 4th years while the south shore of the lake was crawling with police. Dean Hollinshed had called an emergency assembly in the music hall that evening, but he decided that we should not be present. He didn't wish, he explained, to subject us or the other students to the temptation to gossip. So as the rest of the school sat in dumbstruck silence 4 floors below, Wren, Philippa, James, Alexander, Meredith, and I were prisoners at the fireside in Halsworth House. Frederick and Gwendolyn didn't like the idea of leaving us entirely alone, so one of the nurses from the infirmary had been placed as a sentinel outside the door to the rest of the 5th floor, where she sat sniffling into a tissue as she half-heartedly filled in a crossword puzzle. I strained my ears against the suffocating quiet, acutely aware of our schoolmates all gathered together without us. Exile was intolerable. It felt somehow Damoclean, a period of suspended judgment, dreading condemnation by a jury of our peers. Oh, my prophetic soul! Our mercenary relief at having Richard gone was quickly turning sour. Already I'd found 1,000 things to be afraid of. What if one of us let something slip? Talked in our sleep? Forgot how the story was supposed to go? Or perhaps we'd walk on tiptoes the rest of our lives, waiting for the thread to snap.
the axe to fall. Alexander must have been infected by the same anxiety. "Do you think they're going to tell everyone we're up here?" he asked, staring hard at the carpet as though he might suddenly develop X-ray vision and be able to see what was going on downstairs.
"I doubt it," Philippa said. "They won't want anyone sneaking up."
The lines on either side of her mouth were deep and dark, as if she had aged 10 years in as many hours. The others were silent, listening uselessly for a sound from downstairs. James sat with his knees pinned tightly together, arms folded over his chest like he was cold. Wren was listless, limp, her limbs bent into her chair at odd, clumsy angles, like those of a dropped doll. Meredith sat on the couch beside her, cross-legged, fists clenched, tension making every elegant line of her body hard and angular.
"What do you think they'll do about Caesar?" Alexander said, when he couldn't stand the quiet anymore.
"They'll call it off," Philippa said. "It'd be tasteless to just replace him."
"So much for the show must go on." I tried for one abortive moment to imagine someone, anyone else, assuming Richard's role. The threat Gwendolyn had made to have me learn his lines and take his place echoed from my memory, and I balked, recoiled from the idea.
"Honestly," I said, afraid I'd have to scream if I didn't do something else with my voice, "do you really want to get back on stage without him?"
A few heads shook. Nobody spoke.
Then,
"Is it just me?" Alexander said. "Or is this the longest day of everyone else's life?"
"Well," James said, "certainly not Richard's."
Alexander gaped at him, eyes wide and glaring.
"James," Meredith said. "What the fuck?"
Philippa breathed out in a hiss, rubbing her forehead.
"We're not doing this," she said,
then looked up from one of them to each of the others.
"We are not going to bicker and bitch at each other, not about this. Things without all remedy should be without regard. What's done is done."
Alexander laughed a thin, humorless laugh I didn't like at all.
"To bed, to bed, to bed," he said. "God, I need a smoke. I wish they hadn't stuck the nurse outside."
He clambered to his feet, turned on the spot, moving in the quick, restless way he did when he was upset. He wandered around the room in an aimless zigzag, struck a few random notes on the piano, then started opening cupboards and fumbling around on the bookshelves.
"What are you doing?"
Meredith asked.
"Looking for booze," he said. "There must be something hidden in here. The last guest they had was the guy who wrote the Nietzsche book, and I bet my ass he's an alcoholic."
"How can you possibly want to drink right now?" I said. "My insides still feel like liquid from last night."
"Hair of the dog."
"Aha." He emerged from a cabinet in the back of the room with a bottle of something amber in one hand.
"Anyone for brandy?"
"Go on," Philippa said. "Maybe it'll take the edge off."
Glasses clinked together as he rummaged deeper in the cabinet.
"Anyone else?"
Wren didn't speak, but to my surprise, James and Meredith both said yes, please, at precisely the same time. Alexander returned with the bottle in one hand, four glasses stacked and tilting in the other. He poured himself enough brandy to burn the hall down, then passed it to Philippa.
"I don't know how much you want," he said. "Personally, I plan to drink myself to sleep."
"I'm not sure I'll ever sleep again," I said. Richard's half-smashed face, garish as a carnival mask, leapt at me every time I closed my eyes. James, staring into the fire, chewing a fingernail, said,
"Methought I heard a voice cry, 'Sleep no more.'"
"Where are we sleeping?" Meredith asked, ignoring him. "There's only three rooms."
"Well, Wren and I can share," Philippa said with a sidelong look at her. She didn't acknowledge that she'd heard.
"Who wants to share with me?" Alexander said. He waited for a reply, but didn't get one. Don't everyone jump up at once. I'll stay out here, I said. I don't mind.
What time is it?
Meredith said. She lifted her glass to her lips with a pained expression, as if that simple motion were monumentally taxing. Philippa squinted at the carriage clock on the table beside her.
9:15.
Is that all? I said. It feels like midnight. It feels like Judgment Day. Alexander threw back an enormous gulp of brandy, gritted his teeth as he swallowed, and reached for the bottle again. He filled his glass almost to the brim and stood clutching it tightly. I'm going to bed, he announced. If someone decides they don't want to crash in the living room, well, we all know I'm not picky about who I sleep with. Good night. He left the room with a small, stiff bow. I watched him go and propped my head on one hand, unsurprised by how heavy it felt. Exhaustion pumped sluggishly through my veins, dampening everything else. In the raw dark of the morning, I'd felt relief rather than dismay at the spectacle of Richard's death, and now that it was dark again, after all we'd done and said during the long hypnotic hours in between, I was too tired for sadness or pity. Perhaps it was absent because I didn't quite believe it. I half expected Richard to burst through the door, wiping stage blood from his face, laughing cruelly at how he'd had us fooled. Philippa finished her drink, and the sound of her glass touching down on the table made me look up.
I'm going to go to bed, too, she said, pushing herself to her feet. I want to just lie down for a while, even if I don't sleep. Wren, why don't you come to bed?
Wren was still for a moment, then reanimated, unfolded herself from the chair, eyes bleary out of focus. She accepted Philippa's proffered hand and followed her out without protest.
Are you sleeping here? Meredith asked when they'd gone.
She spoke to me as if James wasn't there. He didn't react or respond, as if he hadn't heard her. I nodded.
You take the other bedroom.
She straightened up, slowly, gingerly, like everything hurt. Going to sleep? I asked.
Yeah,
she said.
I hope I never wake up.
The first real pang of sadness stuck me like a needle, but it had nothing to do with Richard. Not really. I wanted to say something, but couldn't find a single adequate word. And so I sat silent and immobile on the couch as she, too, left the room, half her brandy undrunk. When the door closed behind her, I deflated, slumped against the pillows behind me, dragged my hands across my face.
She doesn't mean it, James said.
I frowned behind my fingers. Is that meant to be comforting or critical?
It's not meant to be anything, he said. Don't be angry with me, Oliver. I can't take it right now.
I exhaled and lifted my hands off my face.
I'm sorry, I'm not angry. I'm just, I don't know, drained. We should sleep.
Well, we can try. We lay down, I on one couch, James on the other, but didn't bother trying to find sheets or proper pillows. I smashed a decorative bolster under my head and pulled a throw blanket down over my legs. On the other couch, James did the same, pausing to finish his brandy and what was left of Meredith's. When he was settled, I turned out the lamp on the table behind me, but the room was still saturated with firelight. The flames had shrunk to small buds of yellow, flickering between the logs. As I watched the wood blacken and crumble and collapse, my lungs constricted, refused to take in sufficient air. How swiftly, how suddenly, everything had gone wrong. Where did it even begin? Not with Meredith and me, I told myself, but months earlier. With Caesar? Macbeth? It was impossible to identify point zero.
I squirmed, unable to dismiss the idea that some huge, invisible weight was crushing down on me like a boulder. It was that ponderous, crouching demon, guilt. At the time, I didn't know him, but in the months to come, he would climb onto my chest every night and sit snarling there, an ugly Fuselian nightmare. The fire burned down to embers, and its light slowly left the room, leaking out through the cracks. Lacking oxygen, lightheaded, I tilted back toward unconsciousness, and it was more like suffocating than falling asleep. A whisper brought me back to life.
Oliver.
I sat up and blinked against the gloom at James, but it wasn't him who had spoken.
Oliver.
Meredith had appeared, a pale shape in the dark void of her bedroom door. Her head drooped against the doorframe like a flower bud swollen with rainwater, and for one odd moment I wondered what the weight of her hair was, if she felt it hanging down her back. I pushed my blanket off and crept across the room with another furtive look at James. He lay on his back, head turned to the side, away from me. I couldn't tell if he was dead asleep or trying too hard to fake it.
"What is it?"
I whispered when I was close enough for her to hear me.
"I can't sleep."
My hand twitched toward her, but it didn't get far.
"It's been a bad day,"
I said lamely. She exhaled, gave me a weak nod.
"Will you come in?"
I leaned away from her, forcibly reminded of that night in the dressing room when I'd withdrawn in exactly the same way. She could tempt anyone, but fate didn't seem like a good target. We had one casualty already.
"Meredith,"
I said,
"your boyfriend's dead. He died this morning."
"I know," she said.
"It's not that."
Her eyes were glassy, unapologetic.
"I just don't want to sleep alone."
That little prick of sadness burrowed deeper, touched me at the quick. How well I'd been trained to mistrust her. And by whom? Richard? Gwendolyn? I glanced over my shoulder at James again. All I could see was a shock of his hair sticking up behind the arm of the couch. It didn't really matter where I slept, I decided. Nothing mattered much after that morning. Our two souls, if not all six, were forfeit.
"All right,"
I said. She nodded only once and went back into the room. I followed, closed the door behind me. The blankets on the bed were already disheveled, kicked around, messy. I slid between the sheets in my jeans. I'd sleep in my clothes. We'd sleep. That was all. We didn't touch, didn't even speak. She climbed into the bed beside me and lay down on her side, one arm folded under her pillow. She watched me as I settled myself, propped my own pillow up a little higher. When I stopped moving, she closed her eyes, but not before a few tears leaked out, slipped between her eyelashes. I tried not to feel her trembling against the mattress, but it was like the tick of the mantle clock in the castle. Soft, persistent, impossible to ignore. After what might have been as long as an hour, I lifted my arm without looking at her. She shifted closer, tucked her head against my chest. I curled my arm around her.
"God, Oliver,"
she said. Her voice small and stifled, one hand pressed over her mouth to keep it in. I smoothed her hair flat against her back.
"Yeah,"
I said.
"I know."
Scene 4. Everything was canceled. The remaining performances of Caesar and all of our regular classes before Thanksgiving. We had tea with Frederick twice at Halsworth House, and Gwendolyn ate dinner with us once, but in the two remaining days before break, we saw no one else. On Tuesday, we returned to the castle to collect our things. Richard's death had been officially dismissed as an accident, but this revelation did surprisingly little to allay our unease. That evening we were expected to attend his memorial service, where we would see and be seen by the other students for the first time since Saturday night. The castle was empty, but something in the surrounding woods had changed. There was a foreign smell in the air, of chemicals and equipment, rubber and plastic, the trace odors of a dozen unseen strangers. The stairs leading down to the dock were cordoned off by a bold yellow X of police tape. Up in the tower, I dragged my suitcase out from underneath my bed and packed without paying attention, piling shirts and pants on top of mismatched shoes and socks and rolled-up scarves. For the first time, I was looking forward to a few days at home for Thanksgiving. Normally, Philippa and Alexander and I stayed on campus over break, but Dean Hollinshed had informed us that the school would be closed for the holiday for the first time in 20 years. I bullied my suitcase down the helical stairs to the second floor, swearing and grunting as I pinched my toes under the wheels and crushed my fingers against the banister. I emerged into the library, sweating and irritated, dragging the suitcase behind me. The others had already gone except Philippa, who stood alone in front of the fire with the long brass poker in her hand, pointed down at the floor like a sword. She looked up as I clattered in and threw myself into a chair, deliberately avoiding the closest one, which I still thought of as belonging somehow to Richard. "Has the fire been going all this time?" I asked. "No," she said, lifting the poker to stoke the two skinny logs there. "I lit it." "Why?" "I don't know. It just felt wrong." "Everything feels wrong," I said. She nodded absently. "Are you coming with us to the airport?" "Yes," she said. Camilo had offered to drive the 4th years to O'Hare. From there, Meredith would fly to New York, Alexander to Philadelphia, James to San Francisco. Wren would ride with her aunt and uncle and fly with them to London. They had arrived the previous day, and Hollinshed had arranged for them to have a room in Broadwater's only nice hotel, Halsworth House, being occupied. I was bound for Ohio. When pressed, Philippa told people she was from Chicago, but I had no idea whether she had family there. "And after that?" I asked, trying and failing to make it sound offhand. She didn't answer, just watched the fire, eyes hidden by the reflection of the flames on her glasses. "Pip, I swear I'm not trying to pry." She stabbed at the embers again, a little savagely. "So don't." I shifted in my chair. What I wanted to tell her seemed nonsensically important. "Look, you know you could come home with me if you wanted to, right?" I said abruptly. "I'm not saying you do or you should, just if you needed somewhere to go. I mean, they'd all freak out because I've never brought a girl home, and they'd completely misinterpret it, but just in case. That's all. I'm sorry. I'll shut up now." She turned away from the fire, and I was relieved not to find her frowning. Instead, she looked at me with a sad, stricken expression. I was seized by this strange, unfounded idea that she was debating whether or not to say, "I love you." But the difference between us was that she assumed people just knew those sorts of things, while I was always worried that they didn't. "Oliver," was what she did say. She sighed my name out like it was a breath of something warm and sweet, then leaned back against the mantel, maybe too tired to stand up on her own. "I'm scared." She said it with a wry smile, as if it were somehow embarrassing. "Of what?" I asked, not because there was nothing to be scared of, but because there were so many scary things to choose from. She shrugged. "Of what happens now?" Neither of us spoke again before the clock on the mantel chimed. Philippa glanced up. "It's 5:00. The memorial service was scheduled for 5:30. "God," I said. "Yeah, we should go."
I heaved myself out of my chair with great reluctance, but Philippa didn't move.
"Coming?" I asked.
She blinked at me with a look of blank puzzlement, as if she'd just woken up from a dream she already couldn't remember.
"You go ahead."
She plucked at the front of her sweater, which was streaked with soot.
"I ought to change."
"All right." I hovered, half in and half out of the doorway.
"Pip?" "Yeah?"
"Don't be scared." It was a selfish thing to say. If she lost her nerve, I couldn't imagine what would become of everyone else. She was the only one of us who never flinched. She gave me a smile so fragile I might have imagined it.
"Okay."
Scene 5. I found James at the top of the trailhead, just standing there staring down the path like he couldn't make himself take another step. If he heard me approach, he didn't react, and I waited behind him in twilight silence, unsure of what to do. An owl hooted somewhere in the treetops, perhaps the same owl from Saturday night.
"Do you think it's a bit morbid?"
he asked, without preamble, without even turning around.
"Having the service on the beach?"
"I guess the music hall felt a little too festive," I said. "All that gold."
"You'd think they'd have it as far away from the lake as possible."
"Yeah." I glanced back toward the hall. It might have been Halloween again, James and I lurking like shadows under the trees, but the air was too cold, pressing against my skin like a flat steel blade. "I don't trust it anymore."
"What do you mean?"
"First Halloween, now this," I said with a shrug he didn't see. "It's like the lake's turned on us. Like there's some naiad down there that we've pissed off. Maybe Meredith was right and we should have gone skinny dipping at the start of term." I didn't realize how stupid it sounded until it was out of my mouth.
"Like some kind of pagan ritual?"
James asked, turning his head so I could just see the side of his face, the curve of his cheek.
"Good Lord, Oliver. Sleep with her if you must, but don't let her get inside your head."
"I'm not sleeping with her." I could see that he was about to protest and added, "not, you know, figuratively."
"Doesn't really matter, does it?"
he asked and turned to face me, the movement deliberately casual. Not convincing. "What?"
"Whether it's figurative?"
"I don't understand." He raised his voice so it cut through the soft forest silence like a razor blade.
"No, you must not, because I really don't think you're that sort of idiot."
"James," I said, too mystified to really be angry, "what are you talking about?" He looked away.
"You,"
he said, staring off into the trees.
"You and her."
He grimaced as though saying the words together left a bad taste in his mouth.
"Do you not understand how it looks, Oliver? It doesn't matter if you are or are not actually sleeping with her, it looks bad."
"What do you care how it looks?" I asked, forcing the show of indignation, more unnerved than anything else. His sarcasm was caustic, unfamiliar.
"I don't," he said. "I really don't. I care about you, and what might happen if you carry on like this."
"I don't..."
"I know you don't understand. You never do. Richard is dead."
I glanced back toward the hall again, the quadrate silhouette at the top of the hill. "It's not like we killed him."
"Don't be naive, Oliver, for once in your life. He's been dead 2 days, and his girlfriend's already in bed with you every night?"
He shook his head, thoughts tumbling out in a reckless, implacable rush.
"People won't like it. They'll talk. They'll gossip. That's what people do."
He cupped his hand around one ear and said,
"Open your ears, for which of you will stop the vent of hearing when loud rumor speaks?"
My voice stuck in my throat, dry as chalk.
"Why are you talking about this like we killed him?"
He grabbed the front of my jacket like he wanted to throttle me,
Because it fucking looks like we might have. You think people won't wonder whether someone might have pushed him? You keep sleeping with Meredith, and they'll think it was you.
I stared at him, too surprised to move. His hand was the only solid thing, the brunt of his anger thrust against my chest in the shape of a fist.
James, the police, they've said it was an accident. He hit his head, I said. He fell.
He must have seen the fear in my face, because the hard lines around his eyes and mouth vanished, like someone had cut the right wire to defuse him before he went off.
Yes, of course he did.
He looked down, let go of my jacket, and brushed one hand across the front to smooth the wrinkles out.
I'm sorry, Oliver. Everything's gone sideways.
I offered an awkward shrug, still half-trapped by my nervous paralysis.
It's all right. Forgive me?
Yeah, I said, a split second too late. Always.